You're listening to From the Public Domain, stories and excerpts from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. The Locket by Kate Chopin. One night in autumn, a few men were gathered about a fire on the slope of a hill. They belonged to a small detachment of Confederate forces and were awaiting orders to march. Their gray uniforms were worn beyond the point of shabbiness. One of the men was heating something in a tin cup over the embers. Two were lying at full length a little distance away, while a fourth was trying to decipher a letter and had drawn close to the light. He had unfastened his collar and a good bit of his flannel shirt front.
"What's that you got around your neck, Ned?"
asked one of the men lying in the obscurity. Ned, or Edmund, mechanically fastened another button of his shirt and did not reply. He went on reading his letter.
"Is it your sweetheart's picture?"
"'Tain't no gal's picture,"
offered the man at the fire. He had removed his tin cup and was engaged in stirring its grimy contents with a small stick.
"That's a charm. Some kind of hoodoo business that one of them priests gave him to keep him out of trouble. I know them Catholics. That's how come Frenchy got promoted and never got a scratch since he's been in the ranks. Hey, French, ain't I right?"
Edmund looked up absently from his letter. "What is it?" he asked.
"Ain't that a charm you got around your neck?"
"It must be, Nick," returned Edmund with a smile. "I don't know how I could have gone through this year and a half without it."
The letter had made Edmund's heart sick and homesick. He stretched himself on his back and looked straight up at the blinking stars. But he was not thinking of them, nor of anything, but a certain spring day when the bees were humming in the clematis, when a girl was saying goodbye to him. He could see her as she unclasped from her neck the locket which she fastened about his own. It was an old-fashioned golden locket bearing miniatures of her father and mother with their names and the date of their marriage. It was her most precious earthly possession. Edmund could feel again the folds of the girl's soft white gown and see the droop of the angel's sleeves as she circled her fair arms about his neck. Her sweet face, appealing, pathetic, tormented by the pain of parting, appeared before him as vividly as life. He turned over, burying his face in his arm, and there he lay, still and motionless. The profound and treacherous night, with its silence and semblance of peace, settled upon the camp. He dreamed that the fair Octavie brought him a letter. He had no chair to offer her, and was pained and embarrassed at the condition of his garments. He was ashamed of the poor food which comprised the dinner at which he begged her to join them. He dreamt of a serpent coiling around his throat, and when he strove to grasp it, the slimy thing glided away from his clutch. Then his dream was clamor.
"Get your duds, you! Frenchy!"
Nick was bellowing in his face. There was what appeared to be a scramble and a rush, rather than any regulated movement. The hillside was alive with clatter and motion, with sudden upspringing lights among the pines. In the east, the dawn was unfolding out of the darkness. Its glimmer was yet dim in the plain below.
"What's it all about?"
wondered a big blackbird perched in the top of the tallest tree. He was an old, solitary, and wise one. Yet he was not wise enough to guess what it was all about. So all day long he kept blinking and wondering. The noise reached far out over the plain and across the hills and awoke the little babes that were sleeping in their cradles. The smoke curled up toward the sun and shadowed the plain so that the stupid birds thought it was going to rain. But the wise one knew better.
"They are children playing a game," thought he. "I shall know more about it if I watch long enough."
At the approach of night, they had all vanished away with their din and smoke. Then the old bird plumed his feathers. At last he had understood. With a flap of his great black wings, he shot downward, circling toward the plain. A man was picking his way across the plain. He was dressed in the garb of a clergyman. His mission was to administer the consolations of religion to any of the prostrate figures in whom there might yet linger a spark of life. A Negro accompanied him, bearing a bucket of water and a flask of wine. There were no wounded here. They had been borne away. But the retreat had been hurried, and the vultures and the Good Samaritans would have to look for the dead. There was a soldier, a mere boy, lying with his face to the sky. His hands were clutching the sword on either side, and his fingernails were stuffed with earth and bits of grass that he had gathered in his despairing grasp upon life. His musket was gone. He was hatless, and his face and clothing were begrimed. Around his neck hung a gold chain and locket. The priest, bending over him, unclasped the chain and removed it from the dead soldier's neck. He had grown used to the terrors of war and could face them unflinchingly, but its pathos, someway, always brought the tears to his old dim eyes. The Angelus was ringing half a mile away. The priest and the Negro knelt and murmured together the evening benediction and a prayer for the dead. Part 2. The peace and beauty of a spring day had descended upon the earth like a benediction. Along the leafy road which skirted a narrow, tortuous stream in central Louisiana, rumbled an old-fashioned cabriolet, much the worse for hard and rough usage over country roads and lanes. The fat black horses went in a slow, measured trot, notwithstanding constant urging on the part of the fat black coachman. Within the vehicle were seated the fair Octavie and her old friend and neighbor, Judge Pillier, who had come to take her for a morning drive. Octavie wore a plain black dress, severe in its simplicity. A narrow belt held it at the waist, and the sleeves were gathered into close-fitting wristbands. She had discarded her hoop skirt and appeared not unlike a nun. Beneath the folds of her bodice nestled the old locket. She never displayed it now. It had returned to her, sanctified in her eyes, made precious as material things sometimes are, by being forever identified with the significant moment of one's existence. 100 times she had read over the letter with which the locket had come back to her. No later than that morning, she had again pored over it. As she sat beside the window, smoothing the letter out upon her knee, heavy and spiced odors stole into her with the songs of birds and the humming of insects in the air. She was so young, and the world was so beautiful, that there came over her a sense of unreality as she read again and again the priest's letter. He told of that autumn day drawing to its close, with the gold and the red fading out of the west, and the night gathering its shadows to cover the faces of the dead. Oh! She could not believe that one of those dead was her own. With visage uplifted to the gray sky in an agony of supplication, a spasm of resistance and rebellion seized and swept over her. Why was the spring here with its flowers and its seductive breath if he was dead? Why was she here? What further had she to do with life and the living? Octavie had experienced many such moments of despair. But a blessed resignation had never failed to follow, and it fell then upon her like a mantle and enveloped her. "I shall grow old and quiet and sad, like poor Aunt Tavy," she murmured to herself as she folded the letter and replaced it in the secretary. Already she gave herself a little demure air, like her Aunt Tavy. She walked with a slow glide in unconscious imitation of Mademoiselle Tavy, whom some youthful affliction had robbed of earthly compensation while leaving her in possession of youth's illusions. As she sat in the old cabriolet beside the father of her dead lover, again there came to Octavie the terrible sense of loss which had assailed her so often before. The soul of her youth clamored for its rights, for a share in the world's glory and exaltation. She leaned back and drew her veil a little closer about her face. It was an old black veil of her Aunt Tavy's. A whiff of dust from the road had blown in, and she wiped her cheeks and her eyes with her soft white handkerchief, a homemade handkerchief, fabricated from one of her old fine muslin petticoats.
"Will you do me the favor, Octavie?" requested the judge, in the courteous tone which he never abandoned. "To remove that veil which you wear. It seems out of harmony some way
with the beauty and promise of the day. The young girl obediently yielded to her old companion's wish, and unpinning the cumbersome, somber drapery from her bonnet, folded it neatly and laid it upon the seat in front of her.
"Ah, that is better, far better," he said in a tone expressing unbounded relief. "Never put it on again, dear."
Octavie felt a little hurt, as if he wished to debar her from share and parcel in the burden of affliction which had been placed upon all of them. Again, she drew forth the old muslin handkerchief. They had left the big road and turned into a level plain which had formerly been an old meadow. There were clumps of thorn trees here and there, gorgeous in their spring radiance. Some cattle were grazing off in the distance in spots where the grass was tall and luscious. At the far end of the meadow was the towering lilac hedge, skirting the lane that led to Judge Pillier's house, and the scent of its heavy blossoms met them like a soft and tender embrace of welcome. As they neared the house, the old gentleman placed an arm around the girl's shoulders, and turning her face up to him, he said,
"Do you not think that on a day like this, miracles might happen? When the whole earth is vibrant with life, does it not seem to you, Octavie, that heaven might for once relent and give us back our dead?"
He spoke very low, advisedly and impressively. In his voice was an old quaver which was not habitual, and there was agitation in every line of his visage. She gazed at him with eyes that were full of supplication and a certain terror of joy. They had been driving through the lane with the towering hedge on one side and the open meadow on the other. The horses had somewhat quickened their lazy pace. As they turned into the avenue leading to the house, a whole choir of feathered songsters fluted a sudden torrent of melodious greeting from their leafy hiding places. Octavie felt as if she had passed into a stage of existence which was like a dream, more poignant and real than life. There was the old gray house with its sloping eaves. Amid the blur of green and dimly, she saw familiar faces and heard voices, as if they came from far across the fields. And Edmund was holding her. Her dead Edmund. Her living Edmund. And she felt the beating of his heart against her, and the agonizing rapture of his kisses, striving to awake her. It was as if the spirit of life and the awakening spring had given back the soul to her youth and bade her rejoice. It was many hours later that Octavie drew the locket from her bosom and looked at Edmund with a questioning appeal in her glance.
"It was the night before an engagement," he said, "in the hurry of the encounter and the retreat next day. I never missed it till the fight was over. I thought, of course, I had lost it in the heat of the struggle. But it was stolen."
"Stolen," she shuddered, and thought of the dead soldier with his face uplifted to the sky in an agony of supplication. Edmund said nothing, but he thought of his messmate, the one who had lain far back in the shadow, the one who had said nothing. A Reflection by Kate Chopin. Some people are born with a vital and responsive energy. It not only enables them to keep abreast of the times, it qualifies them to furnish in their own personality a good bit of the motive power to the mad pace. They are fortunate beings. They do not need to apprehend the significance of things. They do not grow weary nor misstep. Nor do they fall out of rank and sink by the wayside to be left contemplating the moving procession. Ah, that moving procession that has left me by the roadside. Its fantastic colors are more brilliant and beautiful than the sun on the undulating waters. What matter if souls and bodies are failing beneath the feet of the ever-pressing multitude? It moves with the majestic rhythm of the spheres. Its discordant clashes sweep upward in one harmonious tone that blends with the music of other worlds, to complete God's orchestra. It is greater than the stars, that moving procession of human energy, greater than the palpitating earth and the things growing thereon. Oh, I could weep at being left by the wayside, left with the grass and the clouds and a few dumb animals. True, I feel at home in the society of these symbols of life's immutability. In the procession, I should feel the crushing feet, the clashing discords, the ruthless hands and stifling breath. I could not hear the rhythm of the march. Salve, ye dumb hearts, let us be still and wait by the roadside. A Pair of Silk Stockings by Kate Chopin. Little Mrs. Summers one day found herself the unexpected possessor of $15. It seemed to her a very large amount of money, and the way in which it stuffed and bulged her worn old portemonnaie gave her a feeling of importance such as she had not enjoyed for years. The question of investment was one that occupied her greatly. For a day or two, she walked about apparently in a dreamy state, but really absorbed in speculation and calculation. She did not wish to act hastily, to do anything she might afterward regret. But it was during the still hours of the night, when she lay awake revolving plans in her mind, that she seemed to see her way clearly toward a proper and judicious use of the money. A dollar or two should be added to the price usually paid for Janie's shoes, which would ensure their lasting an appreciable time longer than they usually did. She would buy so and so many yards of percale for new shirtwaists for the boys and Janie and Mag. She had intended to make the old ones do by skillful patching. Meg should have another gown. She had seen some beautiful patterns, veritable bargains in the shop windows. And still, there would be left enough for new stockings, two pairs apiece, and what darning that would save for a while. She would get caps for the boys and sailor hats for the girls. The vision of her little brood looking fresh and dainty and new for once in their lives excited her and made her restless and wakeful with anticipation. The neighbors sometimes talked of certain better days that little Mrs. Summers had known before she had ever thought of being Mrs. Summers. She herself indulged in no such morbid retrospection. She had no time, no second of time to devote to the past. The needs of the present absorbed her every faculty. A vision of the future like some dim, gaunt monster sometimes appalled her, but luckily tomorrow never comes. Mrs. Summers was one who knew the value of bargains, who could stand for hours making her way inch by inch toward the desired object that was selling below cost. She could elbow her way if need be. She had learned to clutch a piece of goods and hold it and stick to it with persistence and determination till her turn came to be served, no matter when it came. But that day, she was a little faint and tired. She had swallowed a light luncheon. No, when she came to think of it, between getting the children fed and the place righted and preparing herself for the shopping bout, she had actually forgotten to eat any luncheon at all. She sat herself upon a revolving stool before a counter that was comparatively deserted, trying to gather strength and courage to charge through an eager multitude that was besieging breastworks of shirting and figured lawn. An all-gone limp feeling had come over her, and she rested her hand aimlessly upon the counter. She wore no gloves. By degrees, she grew aware that her hand had encountered something very soothing, very pleasant to touch. She looked down to see that her hand lay upon a pile of silk stockings. A placard nearby announced that they had been reduced in price from $2.50 to $1.98, and a young girl who stood behind the counter asked her if she wished to examine their line of silk hosiery. She smiled, just as if she had been asked to inspect a tiara of diamonds with the ultimate view of purchasing it. But she went on feeling the soft, sheeny, luxurious things, with both hands now, holding them up to see them glisten, and to feel them glide, serpent-like, through her fingers. Two hectic blotches came suddenly into her pale cheeks. She looked up at the girl. "Do you think there are any 8½ among these?" There were any number of 8½. In fact, there were more of that size than any other. Here was a light blue pair. There were some lavender, some all black in various shades of tan and gray. Mrs. Summers selected a black pair and looked at them very long and closely. She pretended to be examining their texture, which the clerk assured her was excellent. $1.98, she mused aloud. Well, I'll take this pair. She handed the girl a $5 bill and waited for her change and for her parcel. What a very small parcel it was. It seemed lost in the depths of her shabby old shopping bag. Mrs. Summers, after that, did not move in the direction of the bargain counter. She took the elevator, which carried her to an upper floor into the region of the ladies' waiting rooms. Here, in a retired corner, she exchanged her cotton stockings for the new silk ones which she had just bought. She was not going through any acute mental process of reasoning with herself, nor was she striving to explain to her satisfaction the motive of her action. She was not thinking at all. She seemed, for the time, to be taking a rest from that laborious and fatiguing function and to have abandoned herself to some mechanical impulse that directed her actions and freed her of responsibility. How good was the touch of the raw silk to her flesh! She felt like lying back in the cushioned chair and reveling for a while in the luxury of it. She did for a little while. Then she replaced her shoes, rolled the cotton stockings together, and thrust them into her bag. After doing this, she crossed straight over to the shoe department and took her seat to be fitted. She was fastidious. The clerk could not make her out. He could not reconcile her shoes with her stockings, and she was not too easily pleased. She held back her skirts and turned her feet one way and her head another way as she glanced down at the polished, pointed-tipped boots. Her foot and ankle looked very pretty. She could not realize that they belonged to her and were a part of herself. She wanted an excellent and stylish fit, she told the young fellow who served her, and she did not mind the difference of a dollar or two more in the price, so long as she got what she desired. It was a long time since Mrs. Summers had been fitted with gloves. On rare occasions when she had bought a pair, they were always bargains, so cheap that it would have been preposterous and unreasonable to have expected them to be fitted to the hand. Now, she rested her elbow on the cushion of the glove counter, and a pretty, pleasant young creature, delicate and deft of touch, drew a long-wristed kid over Mrs. Summers' hand. She smoothed it down over the wrist and buttoned it neatly, and both lost themselves for a second or two in admiring contemplation of the little symmetrical gloved hand. But there were other places where money might be spent. There were books and magazines piled up in the window of a stall a few paces down the street. Mrs. Summers bought two high-priced magazines, such as she had been accustomed to read in the days when she had been accustomed to other pleasant things. She carried them without wrapping. As well as she could, she lifted her skirts at the crossings. Her stockings and boots and well-fitting gloves had worked marvels in her bearing, had given her a feeling of assurance, a sense of belonging to the well-dressed multitude. She was very hungry. Another time she would have stilled the cravings for food until reaching her own home, where she would have brewed herself a cup of tea and taken a snack of anything that was available. But the impulse that was guiding her would not suffer her to entertain any such thought. There was a restaurant at the corner. She had never entered its doors. From the outside, she had sometimes caught glimpses of spotless damask and shining crystal, and soft-stepping waiters serving people of fashion. When she entered, her appearance created no surprise, no consternation, as she half feared it might. She seated herself at a small table alone, and an attentive waiter at once approached to take her order. She did not want a profusion. She craved a nice and tasty bite. A half dozen blue points, a plump chop with cress, something sweet, a creme frappe, for instance, a glass of Rhine wine, and after all, a small cup of black coffee. While waiting to be served, she removed her gloves very leisurely and laid them beside her. Then she picked up a magazine and glanced through it, cutting the pages with a blunt edge of her knife. It was all very agreeable. The damask was even more spotless than it had seemed through the window, and the crystal more sparkling. There were quiet ladies and gentlemen who did not notice her, lunching at the small tables like her own. A soft, pleasing strain of music could be heard, and a gentle breeze was blowing through the window. She tasted a bite, and she read a word or two, and she sipped the amber wine and wiggled her toes in the silk stockings. The price of it made no difference. She counted the money out to the waiter and left an extra coin on his tray, whereupon he bowed before her as before a princess of royal blood. There was still money in her purse, and her next temptation presented itself in the shape of a matinee poster. It was a little later when she entered the theater. The play had begun, and the house seemed to her to be packed, but there were vacant seats here and there, and into one of them she was ushered. Between brilliantly dressed women who had gone there to kill time and eat candy and display their gaudy attire. There were many others who were there solely for the play and acting. It is safe to say there was no one present who bore quite the attitude which Mrs. Summers did to her surroundings. She gathered in the whole, stage and players and people, in one wide impression, and absorbed it and enjoyed it. She laughed at the comedy and wept. She and the gaudy woman next to her wept over the tragedy, and they talked a little together over it, and the gaudy woman wiped her eyes and sniffled on a tiny square of filmy, perfumed lace and passed little Mrs. Summers her box of candy. The play was over. The music ceased. The crowd filed out. It was like a dream ended. People scattered in all directions. Mrs. Summers went to the corner and waited for the cable car. A man with keen eyes, who sat opposite to her, seemed to like the study of her small, pale face. It puzzled him to decipher what he saw there. In truth, he saw nothing, unless he were wizard enough to detect a poignant wish, a powerful longing that the cable car would never stop anywhere, but go on and on with her forever. You've been listening to From the Public Domain. I'm your host, Susie Elthens.